Bobby's Rights. This is a true story based on court records and hundreds of hours of interviews, which took 5 years and produced hundreds of hours of video and audio tape. But it's a first draft pitch for a film and will probably never be read by anyone in the industry, which appears to suffer from the death of readers. This screenplay is much better than this. The nonfiction version will be book length and complicated. It's a great story which, like many great American stories, shows our culture at its worst. The only way to tell is to change the names to protect the ignorant and incompetent as well as the guilty. In this version, too long to be a pitch and too short to be a screenplay, time has been collapsed and portions of the story deleted for brevity. Robert Joe Moody read 3 drafts of the script and made important suggestions. He has been tried twice and convicted twice, even after both juries heard top psychiatrist and a psychologist plainly state that he should be found not guilty by reason of insanity. This was the last case tried in Arizona that could have had the insanity verdict. All future juries will only have the choice of guilty but insane. To believe that people can be possessed at all, and especially by parts of themselves, is hard for most people. And the politics of these beliefs show up like a scar of vicious vengeance in our courtrooms. If you knew the truth, the ignorant that call themselves human think justice is involved in taking life for being insane. They don't just believe themselves are insane or run by anything, yet it's plain to those with eyes to see that they're asleep in the common environmental trance, perfect hypnotic subjects believing that they cannot be hypnotized, and that even if they were, there would be no way for them to make them do something against their will and out without their knowledge. God forbid, they say from their trance. There's no such thing as multiple personalities. There's only one body, so there can only be one personality. But after the new MRI scan studies of people with DID manifesting alters showing up different parts of the brain lighting up is properly covered by the press, people will understand that DID is real and one of the best-kept secrets of the cryptocracy. Educate at their discretion, Jefferson said. Robert Moody is presently being housed in one of the oldest and most dilapidated prisons in the nation, the Arizona State Prison in Florence. After being incarcerated for almost 10 years, Robert Joe Moody's records show him as a model prisoner. While in custody, he has received no treatment for his headaches or his mental illness. He has attempted suicide twice, even though he had repeatedly stated that it wasn't afraid of dying by lethal injection or the gas chamber because the aliens had promised to resurrect him. This is a treatment for a film of a screenplay called Bobby's Rights. The police video captured the only time Robert Moody was read the Miranda warnings. It was when he was occupied by a 9-year-old personality who answers to the name Bobby. None of his other personalities were read their rights. At dawn, a steady rain pours down upon Orange, California. A postman on his way to work. To the east, the storm clouds part, and the sunrise bathe the scene briefly in an orange light. The postman approaches a bus stop and ducks under a roof. On the bench, he sees a small, frightened form of Bobby, about 9 years old, hidden beneath a blanket of newspapers. The boy opens up his sleepy eyes and looks around, noticing a variety of small details. Strange and alien from his child's point of view, a puddle reflects an upside-down world. The postman grins at Bobby from the puddle. Fear crosses the boy's face, and he quickly hides beneath the papers. Postman notices the boy and smiles. The smile makes it safe. Bobby sits up, rubbing his eyes with a badged right hand. Bobby looks around again as the rain slows. The sun cuts through the fog and clouds are bobbing, sniffs the air. He bends over to touch the ground, then points his finger to his lips, rubbing his eyes and then yawns. Bobby asks the postman where he can find a place to sleep, and the postman recommends the homeless shelter run by Reverend Edwards. Bobby walks off in the direction indicated, splashing through the puddles, examining the details of the strange, updying world that still reflects in them. few moments later, he comes to the mission. The rain has stopped. The sun shines clearly as Bobby stands timidly on the wet corner studying the mission. He notices the heavy bars on the storefront windows and watches a few homeless people slosh in before their approaches to the front door. Inside the mission, hungry homeless people sit at big tables devouring bacon and eggs and toast with butter and jam and drinking pots and pots of coffee. Volunteers dish out food to hungry newcomers. Bobby timidly joins the end of the line and makes his way through it. He then makes his way to an empty table, sits hesitantly, and then begins gobbling down the victuals like a working dog turned loose on an evening chow. Reverend Edwards walks slowly past the tables, ad-libbing with his guests. He stops at Bobby's table, chats with a young man who discloses he can't remember who he is. The Reverend suggests he walk a few blocks to the Orange County Sheriff's Office and have his prints run for identification on the new computer system at the Sheriff's Office. Bobby ambles up Valencia Street, absently looking over his new world. As he passes a large window in the background reflecting the subtle image of Bob, the 35-year-old version of Bobby, who gets lost in a palimpsest set of reflected images, cars moving, people walking past the window, cars and trucks and buses, there goes our motorcycle, a ballet of city forms warped by the bent reflections in the shop windows. At the bottom of a steep flight of steps to the sheriff's office, Bobby cranes his neck way back to look up at the sandstone letters over the doors. He begins the long climb up the mountain of steps. At the top, he pauses to wipe sweat from his brow and looks back like a young Edmund Hillary at the summit of Everest for the first time. Inside the station, the desk sergeant watches Bob enter. Just another lost, homeless person. Bobby holds up his 10 fingers, grins, and tells the sergeant that Reverend sent him over to get his fingerprints tested by the computer so he can find out who he is. A print technician leads the way through the door with Bobby following. The tech directs Bobby to the sink inside the slab and takes his prints, then ushers him back to the waiting room. Through a window, we see the technician silently report to the sergeant, who gathers 4 deputies. They huddle around the computer, then check their equipment and leave the office together, entering the waiting room. The deputies approach Bobby casually from different directions. While the technician invites Bobby back into the room, the others put handcuffs on him before the technician tells him his name is Robert Joe Moody and that he's wanted for 2 counts of murder in Tucson, Arizona. Later, we find Bobby strapped naked to a bunk in the psych unit of the Orange County jail cell. Bars outside the narrow windows cast long shadows across the cell. Sounds of the psycho ward, screaming, yelling, singing, headbanging in metal walls. There's a sudden clang to the door opening. Bobby's scared. He tries to sit up, only to discover he's strapped down. 2 guards come in. One entraps his right hand. He sits up, and the second guard offers him food in plastic containers on a plastic tray. He's given no utensils and is told to eat the gruel with his own free hands. The stew runs down his arm. From the ceiling, we look down upon little Bobby as he struggles to feed himself under the intimidating presence of the guards. 4 days later, in the visitation room of the jail, a concealed video camera captures the action. Preceded by an Oriental man, Pima County Sheriff's Detective Samuel Sting, Bobby shuffles into a conference room in handcuffs and leg irons. He is followed by middle-aged Tucson PD homicide detective Catherine Blight. Bobby begins to pick at the scab. Detective Sting sets up his tape recorder as Detective Blight removes the cuffs from the suspect. While Bobby picks at the infected scab, Detective Bling reads in the Miranda warnings and asks him if he understands them. He says he guesses so, but we know he doesn't. A few days later, in the Pima County Attorney's Office, the prosecuting attorney, Darrell Black, meets with Detective Sting and Blight to discuss the case. He tells them in no uncertain terms that they should make a deal with a convict they have in custody. Trade him a release on his car theft charges in return for his false testimony that Bob told him he killed the 2 women in Tucson. The next day, in the detective's office, we meet with their snitch in the Los Angeles Police Department and set up the frame getting Juan Lopez to tell the story they need to obtain for an easy indictment. Act 2. Later, in the Pima County Jail, we see Bob, about 35, sitting in the day room in his orange prison fatigue, smoking a cigarette, bum from a pod mate. The television is playing an episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation. Bob looks up from his writing on a yellow legal pad. On TV sees the Star Trek episode, The Game, about Wesley Crusher falling for a young engineering ensign, while the rest of the crew seem to be brainwashed by a new interactive game that they wear over their eyes. Riker believes it's just a game, but it takes over his thoughts too. Bob gets a dizzying headache, holds his head, and lays back on the bench, and has a flashback in which he's laying on an examination table in a room with glowing white floor, walls, and ceilings. Bands of shadow him on the table, surrounding him as a team of Nordic aliens. They are completely human, but exceptionally tall, with piercing blue eyes and Prince Valiant haircuts. Their hair is white. They are almost albinos. There is the hint of something Nazi-like about them. In the background are several grays and some black, cloaked robotic figures that move like digital mercury with the speed and stealth of panthers. The alien's telling me he's been chosen for an important mission. Another flashback lap dissolves over the alien scene. Now Bob goes back in November 1993, when he was sitting in his Lincoln Town Car parked in the shadows of a large tree up the tree from Hollywood, in a territorial home in a good neighborhood. Bob sits behind the wheel in his best suit and tie, and next to Bobby is the passenger seat. Someone in the back seat lights a cigarette. The lighter illuminates other characters in the back seat. Robert, a stiff intellectual nitpicker, cleans his fingernails. XE, in deep shadows, slouched like a cloaked Bella Lucy figure, blurred so he cannot make him out. Suddenly, a bright halogen light comes on the carport of the house. It shines through slots of a fence, stripping the Lincoln with shadows. Gary Stallone, a tall, slim, fastidious man, leaves the house by the side door. He gets into his 1952 Mercedes sports convertible, starts the engine, and gently revs it, evenly, precisely, following factory specs. Bobby watches the Mercedes from the Lincoln through the stripes of a shadow. It backs out of the driveway and heads down the street and reaches the corner. The taillights glow brightly at the stop sign. The car turns right and speeds away. Bob opens his door, puts Bobby gently in the back seat, and tucks him in, then leads the other figures to the house. Inside the house, a stunning beauty, Sherry, sits with her feet on the desk talking on the phone to Darlene, a blonde getting dressed before a mirror as she cradles the phone under her chin. We watch Darlene dress from garter belt to bustier, no panties or bra, until we see her painting freckles across her nose and putting her hair into pigtails to complete the image of a young girl in a short dress of a French schoolgirl. The scene intercuts between Darlene and Sherry's house while they talk. Sherry paints her fingernails while she talks, cradling the phone between her right shoulder and ear. She glances up at the TV from time to time. On the TV in the background, in both scenes, the same show is on, UFO Encounters. The host of the show, Dr. Friedman Floman, is a good-looking brunette who poses an interesting figure with her long ponytail and black-eyed patch. Her co-host is Tim, a pedantic public librarian. The conversation is synchronously matched between Darlene and Sherry's conversation about the UFO show on TV. Outside, Bob passes a rose bush filled with blossoms. He pauses a moment, switches to XE, looks up and down the street, then pulls the rosebush out of the ground with one smooth motion. He walks a few steps, pounds the root ball into a tree, and fluffs up a bunch into almost presentable bouquet. At the door to Sherry's house, he morphs to Bob, gently pushes the others aside, and advances to ring to the doorbell. Inside the house, the dog starts barking. The door opens a crack, wooden the chain on. Sherry peers out, recognizes Bob, and invites him inside. She sees only Bob, but we see both Bob Alters and him at the same time. Sherry shuts the door and takes the barking dog to the laundry room, and locks him inside. Then returns to the door, removes the chain, and opens it. Bob holds out the roses, with dirt still clinging to the roots. Sherry offers Bob a drink and a line of cocaine, and they begin to talk. While she's just been told over the phone that Darlene has left them, she doesn't let on. Bob asks if she knows where Darlene is, and she says she doesn't. Bob pulls the note Darlene left him out of a pocket and hands it to Sherry. As she begins to read it, Bob hears the voice of XE in his head telling him to get on with the mission. A few moments later, we see Bob backing his car into the parking space of his condo. His next-door neighbor, Peg Stagma, is outside watering his spectacular rose garden. The rising sun cuts through slats of her faces, stripping the scene with shadows. She smiles and waves at Bob warmly, but Bob ignores her and rushes into his townhouse. Inside Bob's condo, he goes to the kitchen sink and washes his hands compulsively over and over. After drying his hands on a towel, he goes to the refrigerator, removes a plastic gallon container of milk, and lifts it to his mouth and drinks. Milk spills down the front of the sweater. After he's finished drinking, he wipes up the sweater with the same towel and then takes it off. His shirt has large blood stains which have soaked through the sweater. Bob walks down the hall to the bathroom, takes off his shirt and throws it in the sweater into a plastic bag, undresses and gets under the shower. He closes his eyes, leans back against the wall under the streaming warm water, and then turns toward the back where he enters another flashback. It's months before. Bob's walking down the street after lunch on his way back to the office in high-rise building. Several times along the way, he is greeted cheerfully by people he knows. At his building, he joins a small group of waiting on the elevator. A fellow employee, Max British, makes small talk with him. The elevator door opens on the 22nd floor, and Bob exits while Max stays in the car. Opposite the elevator, a large opaque glass window reads, Providential Insurance. Bob enters the office suite, pauses at the reception desk, and looks at the few phones messages accumulated during lunch. As he turns to go into his office, he recognizes the elderly couple who have been waiting patiently on the couch. He extends his hand to Mr. Rosenblum, who shakes it feebly. He bends and gives Mrs. Rosenblum a peck on the cheek. He turns to Mr. Rosenblum, who's struggling to standing position, reaches over and helps him to his feet. Bob laughs and takes Sherry Rosenblum's arm, hooks it into his own arm, and leads the way into his big office. On the opaque pane of his door, the gold letters announce, Robert J. Moody, District Manager. At the end of his workday, Bob rides to the parking garage, says goodbye to several other employees as they all go to their separate cars. A few moments later, he pulls his well-polished Lincoln Town Car into the driveway of his condo. Soft music is playing inside. The place is immaculate, decorated, and soft tones showing the touch of a female. The drapes are drawn, candles burn in several places, the smoke of incense curls up in baroque lines. From the master bedroom, Darlene emerges in a sheer robe which displays her physique, the figure of a Fredericks of Hollywood model. She picks up two martinis at the door and carries them to the door where Bob is standing transfixed, smiling in intense appreciation. She hands him one glass and raises the other. Bob smiles. They clink glasses and drink. He reaches under the bar, pulls up a silver tray with white powder piled in lines to a silver straw. He bends down and snorts two lines as Darlene comes over to him, still holding her glass. He offers her the tray. She snorts two lines and then begins to rub her body against him, purring like a cat. Bobby responds all smiles. Darlene takes Bobby's coat off, folds it neatly, and places it on the back of the sofa. She then undoes Bobby's tie and unbuttons the top few buttons on his shirt while she licks his ear and comes around in front of him. Bobby gets lightheaded and comes up for air, morphing back to Bob. Darlene goes over to a bar and puts down her martini glass. She goes to the bedroom and, standing in the door, lets her robe fall to the floor. She's wearing a sexy bustier with garter belt and sheer stockings. And she closes the bedroom door with her hand left as we glimpse her right picking up two pairs of handcuffs. The next day, Bob is taken to his office, We notice chafe marks on his wrists. He handles a client's complaint about having been pressured to roll over his life insurance policy. After the call, he pauses, pulls out a desk drawer, bends over it, snorts white powder, which is raked into lines in a single-edged razor blade. After three lines, he pauses, takes a deep breath, then picks up the phone and dials, asking to speak to Mr. Bloom. Once Bloom is on the line, Bob complains to him about the rollover policy, saying that they've got to fix this because it's illegal and it's hurting their clients. Obviously, Bloom doesn't agree. Bob hangs up the phone, puts a sheet of letterhead into his electric, and begins typing. At the end of this emotional day, Bob enters one of his paranoid states. He begins to see shadows, alien robotic shadows, grays and XE-like figures lurking at the periphery of his vision. He picks up his briefcase and leaves the office, stumbling to the men's room. As he stands before the sink washing up his hands, a dark robotic alien moves up behind him in the mirror. He turns. There's nothing there. He takes his briefcase with him into the room containing only commodes surrounded by floor-to-ceiling marble walls behind a desk's thick oak door. Bob locks the door and shutters, then sits on the closed toilet seat. He hears scratching on the door and sees small gray figures reaching under and above the door. The handle begins to turn even though it's locked. He grabs the handle, holds on to it. More scaly gray fingers reach around, above and below. They begin to pull, the hinges begin to bend. Bob pulls on the handle, trying to keep the door in place. The door creaks as it's pulled, and slowly outwards becomes. Bob struggles with all his might, and just as the door is about to come off the hinges, he begins to yell for help. The sounds of someone entering the bathroom precede sounds of the nails screwing away on the tile. Bob lurches from the toilet to encounter a maintenance man. He looks at the door and then sees long scratches at the top and bottom and around the doorknobs. He rushes into the hall towards the elevator. Spilling papers from his valise, Bob lunges into the car just before the door closes. At each floor, Bob expects an alien to enter. He sees them on each floor behind the people getting on, but none dare enter. Finally, at the garage level, Bob rushes to his car. Shadows scurry toward him between cars. He gets into his car and peels out, ramming through the wooden gate before the attendant can raise it. He rockets out of the garage just before the alien catches up. He drives like a madman all the way home, catching glimpses of aliens emerging from the doorways and side streets along the shadowy way. At his townhouse, Bob finds Darlene, an altar of Darlene. Wearing freckles, dressed as a little French girl with her buttocks bare. Bobby emerges and goes to her comfort. He tells her the aliens are after him. She says he's just being paranoid and puts her arms around Bobby to hug him. XE comes out, enough to slap her so hard she falls against the wall and melts to the ground. Then Bobby returns, shaking in terror, and crawls under the bed. A week later, we find Bob sitting at his desk with his head leaning on the back of the hands, one over the other, watching the executive pendulum swing. The mail clerk comes in and picks up the letters in Bob's out basket. He leaves one in his in basket. His paycheck is there, plus a check covering 2 weeks' severance pay. It's accompanied by a pink slip. Bob's eyes grow wide, then they narrow. The letters on the pink slip begin to crawl off the paper. That evening, at his condo, Bob backs his Lincoln into his parking space. He shuts off the ignition, exits, and furtively rushes into the condo expecting to find the comfort of Darlene. Inside, he finds books, records, CDs, and papers scattered everywhere. Drawers are closed, and closet doors are thrown open. Cushions are removed from chairs and couches. The biggest couch is turned over with its bottom knifed open. He shuffles down the hall to the bedroom and finds it has been ransacked. The bedclothes have been stripped and the mattress is turned over. He looks into the master bedroom and sees that the medicine cabinet has been emptied. There are pills and first aid gear scattered around the corner. When he closes the medicine cabinet, he finds a note taped to the mirror. He takes it from the mirror and returns it to the bedroom. He looks around in sadness, sits on the bed, and reads the note that says, "Goodbye, it's over. Don't try to find me. You're crazy. D." Holding the note in his hands, he morphs into Bobby and fights back the tears. Bobby leans forward and puts his face in his hands and begins to cry softly. Later that night, we find his neighbor, Peg, at home, salting a bowl of hot popcorn. When she pours herself another 7 and 7, we realize that she's quite drunk. The TV's on in the background, playing her favorite show. There's a knock on the door. She stumbles on a step, then opens the door while she's still chewing corn. Bob enters, going to the kitchen, grabs the phone book, and turns the pages to locksmiths. He runs his index finger to one number, picks up the phone, and dials a locksmith, telling him he's locked the keys in his car. Bob hangs up the receiver and goes to the front room, where he takes the couch and Peg offers him a bowl of popcorn. Bob takes a big handful, morphs into Bobby, devours it, then takes another big handful. The two share the popcorn in front of the television set, which is showing yet another episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Bob talks with his mouth full. The two eat popcorn together. When the bowl is finished, Peg gets up and goes to the kitchen, returning with a larger metal bowl, thinking it's more popcorn. Bob reaches in. When he touches fresh rose petals, he begins to twitch. Peg stops him just in time, telling him it's rose petals drying from the hot potpourri. From Bob's POV, Peg morphs into an old, ugly hag eating rose petals, not popcorn, then back to her familiar self. Bob's suspended as a puppet gets hung up by his strings when the act is over. This lasts for just an instant. Then the evil eyes of XC slide into Bob's sockets, and we realize that Bob is no longer present, but XC is. Later, Peg, the front door opens, and XC comes out moving like a digital Black Panther from the house of Peg's car, a 1992 Chevy Suburban 4x4. XE gets behind the wheel and peels out of the driveway. Suddenly, Bob's behind the wheel, following XE's backseat orders. And soon, sighing for interest of the looms ahead. Across the town door, the Stallone house opens and Gary Stallone puts his keys away. He calls out for his wife, Sherry, but there's no answer. He walks down the hall to her office and the chairs are upset. Things from the desk are scattered on the floor, blood smeared in the wall and carpet. He hurries down the hall to the bedroom. The door is shut. He pushes against it and finds it blocked. He peers through the crack and sees why it's blocked. He pushes harder, and the door opens to reveal a lifeless body of Sherry tied to a chair. She's covered with blood, stabbed, bludgeoned, and shot. Gary Stallone goes through the motions in trying to revive her. He's cold and stiff. Is he acting, or is he in a state of shock? Later, police and sheriff's vehicles fill the driveway. Other vehicles are parked at the curb in front of the house. Inside the house, Detective Samuel Sting leaves the back bedroom where the body of Sherry is being examined by the coroner. He comes down the hall, carefully steps over a pool of blood, and enters the dining room. The house is swarming with homicide techs taking fingerprints, footprints, photographs, while the homicide worker drones lay plastic runners throughout the house. Detective Blight flips through her notebook. Meanwhile, the Dodge is entering the outskirts of Las Vegas. Robert's driving while Bob and Bobby sleep curled up against the door. XC is in the back seat wearing a wide-brimmed black hat pulled down over his eyes, and a dark scarf pulled up over his mouth, as if he's turned to stone. The car drives down the strip towards Circus Circus. In a long montage, XE, Robert, and Bob lose money. Bobby keeps trying to play the slots and is stopped by Bob. After losing most of their money, the Alters take off again, this time heading south. Bob drives, Bobby sits next to him, and in the back seat are Robert and XE. Bob and his group of bored Alters drive to Los Angeles. They ride in Peg Stagman's car, driving past a long fenced section of land. The sun shines through the fences, producing a strobe effect, flickering shadows and light, shadows and light. From the flickering emerges a palimpsest of images, similar to the effect of early zoetropes. There are mixed images of Bob, Bobby, Robert, and XC in the audience of The Price is Right and some zany game shows. Bob's face appears at its scene as America's Most Wanted and Hard Copy. On their way across the desert, Bob notices the gas gouge. Bobby crawls over the seat and curls up into the back seat. Robert climbs into the front and leans over to look at the gouge. A black hitchhiker stands on the shoulder of the road with his thumb out. Bob begins to slow the vehicle. It stops next to the hitchhiker, Juan Lopez, who sticks his face into the window. Bob negotiates some gas money from Juan and invites him to share the ride to L.A. Of course, not seeing the altars, Juan throws his bag on top of them in the back seat. Juan hands a $5 to Bob. Bob pulls the Suburban into a gas station, goes inside, pays, then comes out and takes the nozzle from the pump. Bobby shows up at his side with Bob's help. Bobby puts the nozzle in the tank and pulls the big handle with both his little hands. When Juan hears the ding, he slides into the driver's seat, starts the engine, and floors it. The Suburban roars away from the station, leaving Bobby standing by the pump with a nozzle in his hand. Bob begins to chase the car, gaining in on it for a moment. Juan stomps on the accelerator and the car zooms off, leaving Bob in the road, choking on exhaust fumes. He throws a rock at the car, then shakes his fist at it along with Robert, Bobby, and XE. All are breathing hard after the car is pulled away. They walk back toward the gas station, pass it, and go to San Bernardino Sheriff's substation like a gang of homeless. Bob walks up to the desk. A deputy greets him. Bob tells him he wants to report the theft of his vehicle. After the report is filled, the deputy asks Bob if he wants a ride to the outskirts of town so that he can hitchhike. The two exit the substation and enter a prowler. The deputy pulls out and turns on a siren, giving Bob a swift ride to the outskirts of town. When the siren goes on, Bob morphs into Bobby, who presses his face to the wind and smiles in an insane smile, facing away from the deputy. The prowler stops at a good place to hitchhike, and Bob exits and just stands there as the prowler does a U-turn, crosses the meridian of the highway, and heads back to town. The deputy waves as Bob passes. Bob waves back, then puts out his thumb in the universal hitching signal at a car going 80 miles an hour. The blur of the car speeding past links to a memory in Bob's mind. Bob smells the rose bushes he's given. XE possesses him. Bob struggles against it before his hands pull out a knife. Sherry grabs the blade and holds onto it, slicing her palm deeply. Blood gushes from her. They struggle and fall to the floor. The blade breaks. He gets up and drags her to the bedroom. He watches his hand pull a phone cord from the wall and ties Sherry's left hand to the arm of a chair. Something controls his body. He moves robotically with a mechanical grace, watching his hand stab Sherry on the right side with a small knife. He sees his hands hit her head with the butt of a .22 cal rifle several times. XE strikes hard, but the butt is plastic and bounces off her without doing much damage. He watches XE's hands aim the rifle at the side of her head and pull the trigger. Her head flops sideways. There's a hole in her temple. Earl, Bob's father, stands next to the Nordic alien watching the mayhem. Gary Stallone, Sherry's husband, supports the murderous behavior with body language you often see at a basketball game when the home team sinks a three-pointer as XC shoots her in the head from various angles and finally puts a bullet into her heart. After the flashback is over, we find Bob back in the jail day room. Has wadded up the tablet in both its powerful hands. Beads of sweat run down his face. He bolts from the bench and runs to his cell where he throws himself on the bunk, holds his head, begins to pull his chair, cries and moans. He stands, paces back and forth with clenched fists. Later, Bob is dressed in jailhouse orange fatigues, telling the story to David Turner, a reporter for the Tucson Citizen. He tells him how extraordinary, extrasensory, biological entities possessed him and made him kill the two women. Robert wears ankle shackles and handcuffs as he shuffles into the courtroom into the mandatory two-piece orange polyester jail wear. He sits heavily at the table across from Don Griddle, the public defender. Griddle opens a folder and pulls out a stack of papers. On top of his clipping from the front page of the Tucson Citizen, the headline reads, "Accused murderer Moody confesses ET's made him kill." In the plush suburban ranch house of Frieda Floman, we see the rewards of excellence hanging in frames on the wall. Several ACE awards for national recognition in television production. Frame BS degrees, a PhD in psychology from the University of Arizona, a certificate for international who's who of intellectuals. Lounging by the pool in a flattering swimsuit, Frieda reads the newspaper. One of her hands holds a Monte Cristo cigar, a quarter smoked. Not taking her eyes off the lead story, she puts the cigar into a Monte Cristo ashtray, picks up the phone and dials. She talks to his defense attorney and arranges her own interview with the alien killer. Later, that week in the jail, Bob shuffles and dresses the same orange jail wear. His hands are still cuffed, as are his ankles. Waiting for him in the room are Frieda and Clark. Clark struggles to operate the camera. Frieda holds an oversized microphone like a penis, pointing it right at Bob. Bob smiles at Frieda, sticks out his cuffed right hand and shakes hers, telling her he's a big fan of her program. Bob and Frieda wait for Clark to get the camera running. We already know he's a klutz. Finally, the red light goes on. Frieda waits a few seconds, then points out the big microphone at Bob and begins her questioning, asking him to explain what he means by extrasensory biological entities. Bob stops and puts his face in cuffed hands. He struggles to fight back Bobby's tears, but his shoulders begin to heave. The camera keeps running and finally composes himself, takes a deep breath of air, sighs, and puts Bob's hands down. Frieda pauses. She looks at the clipping again, tries to collect her thoughts, but blurts out her feelings, saying that he's a killer and he deserves to die in prison. Bob gives her a hardened look, then explodes into XE, who struggles to Bob's full 6'1" height, and he menacingly looks over Frieda. Clark hides behind the camera and clutches as if he's going to back up the tripod and use it to defend himself. We see XE beginning to take Bob over again. The inner struggle of Bob against XE is noticeable to us, but not to Clark, to the untrained eye. Bob wins the struggle over XE, settling him down, and resumes. Later, in Superior Court, the black-robed young Judge Herman Hackman, wearing a weeks-grown beard, whispers into his cell phone while a defense attorney argues for his client. As he folds up his cell phone, we notice that his gold Rolex. In contrast to the defendants, and even the attorneys, his opulence is almost offensive as he puts on his expensive gold-framed glasses and returns his attention to the courtroom. Two national camera crews, plus Frieda's UFO encounters crew, begin to set up their equipment. In the judge's private chamber, he meets with Prosecutor Black, Detective Blight, and Detective Sting and tells them that everything's set for the trial. Black tells them there are only a few loose ends. The informant, they put the squeeze on his skipped out and won't be able to testify. Hackman tells that they got a secret grand jury indictment already based upon Lopez's testimony and that the public defenders know never to challenge a grand jury indictment. So the trial will continue and nobody's noticed that Lopez isn't called to testify. A moment later, in the courtroom, everyone standing as Judge Hackman re-enters the take place on his bench. Don Griddle gets up from the audience and moves to the defense table. Griddle spreads out papers on the table and looks at them in a moment, putting them in order. Robert sits in the jury section, glaring at Judge Hackman. As the judge responds to the defense attorney's request to have the accused evaluated at the rundown mental health facility. After the judge sends him off for a 30-day evaluation, Robert protests. He says he's not insane, he wants to fulfill his mission. Both the defense attorney and the Judge Hackman look over Robert for a moment, and then they ignore him. Deputy sheriffs manhandle the shackled prisoner out of the side door. In the Phoenix psych unit, we see Bobby dressed in an orange jail wearing, being led in, hands chained to his wallet and waist, shuffling along an ankle chains into the dilapidated mental facility. As Bobby passes a glass partition, we see Bob in orange jail wearing reflected on it. The guards escort Bobby to a holding cell. We see Bobby. They only see Bob. The door clanks shut. With much ranting of chains, they take off Bobby's menaces and bracelets. The first guard gathers up the hardware. In the background are sounds of the faculty. Moaning. Someone has been moaning continuously. Distant cursing, shouting starts. Sounds of fist hitting the inmate. Sounds of his body hitting the floor. Sounds and shadows of punching and kicking a body. Laughter from a witness to this off-screen event. Clinging of the cell door. Footsteps fade into the distance. A guard escorts the doctor to the cell door and opens it. Dr. Knotts enters looking at the clipboard. Without looking at Bobby, he begins to speak. Bobby just looks at the doctor without answering. The doctor hasn't hit up the clipboard. Bob's silence causes him to finally look at the prisoner patient. Bob manifests and asks the doctor if he's an alienist. Don Knotts is surprised that a prisoner would know the term for a shrink who specializes in forensic psychiatry. He stares at Bob for a moment, surprised by his patient's intelligence. This is not the usual uneducated, unintelligent prisoner. The next day, Bob sits at the table in the test room, absently shuffling through the pages of the test. This time, a psychologist, Dr. Garfield, sits across the table from Bob with his chair turned sideways at the table. He reads some other report, waiting for Bob to finish the rest. The voice of XE tells him to do the choo-choo train, and Bob starts marking the test true-true, false-false, true-true, without even reading the questions. Then Robert takes over and asks Bob what he thinks he's doing, and Bob begins correcting the answers he made from the TTF pattern, and begins to read the questions and answer them correctly before XE takes him over again and tells him to go back to the choo-choo train pattern. Later, Bob is visited by his defense attorney, Don Griddle. In the attorney-client conference room, while they talk, XE stands behind, whimpering into his ear from time to time. Griddle sees only Bob. Back in the day room, Robert sits at the steel picnic table in the day room, writing on a yellow pad. The TV is set bolted high on the wall. On the screen, a news report comes from CNN about the O.J. Simpson trial. The announcer compares the trial of O.J., run by high-paid lawyers, to that of Kevin Ferguson, the man who killed six people on the train in Connecticut, who obviously suffered from DID and had some of the same fate as Moody. He was maneuvered to represent himself. News clips contrast the two trials and demonstrate who might be happening to Moody had he money been had to hire attorneys and correct representation. 2 months later, in the Superior Courtroom, Bob sits alone at the defense table waiting for Judge Hackerman and his lawyer to arrive. The bailiff chats with two deputies casually. No one is concerned about the model prisoner. In Judge Hackman's private chamber, two men dressed in black sit in chairs before the judge's desk. The second man in black is Earl, Moody's father. He's older now, but still recognizable, even under his dark sunglasses. The first MIB explains that Moody must be convicted and sentenced to death no matter what it takes, and if that doesn't happen, the judge will have to worry about his family's safety. Judge Hackman can't look the man in the eye. Back in the courtroom, Bobby sits at the table looking around the room at the camera crews assembled there. In the best position, the UFO encounter crews stand by ready to video the proceedings. Clark adjusts the camera. Frieda sits in the chair reading Operation Mind Control. Bobby turns and smiles his characteristic Bobby smile to Frieda, who has looked up from her book. Griddle enters loudly, cloping to the front of his cowboy boots. He removes his big gray cowboy hat and puts it on the seat. Judge Hackerman enters and announces that, while this is supposed to be the preliminary conference, Moody has filed a handwritten motion requesting a substitution of attorney. Judge Hackman looks at this motion, which is written in bold black letters with a magic marker. Don Griddle enters the plea of not guilty by reason of sanity. The judge tells him there is no longer such a plea in Arizona. He can enter the plea of guilty but insane, the new plea, but before Griddle can explain that his case, because of its date, still falls under the old law, Moody protests, saying that he's not insane and he wants to represent himself. The judge says he still will not let him do that if he has legal advisors that tell him. Moody picks Hank Vito, a long-haired attorney with apparent liberal attitudes. Later in the Pinckney County Jail, Bob is working the phone. He tries to speak with former President Carter, but gets his aide. He requests Carter as a witness in his trial. His aide says maybe. Next, he calls Dr. John Mack's office at Harvard and asks his aide for the UFO alien abduction shrink to testify at his trial. He gets another maybe. Bob hangs up, and that lets his fingers do the down the street to the list. His finger stops on the name Senator Barry Goldwater. He dials the number of the Mountain View rest home, gets a desk to promise to relay the message to the feeble former presidential candidate who made public statements expressing his belief in UFOs. The administrator agrees he'll tell the senator. The next time on his list is former President Gerald Ford, who also has expressed a belief in UFOs. Another maybe. Bob hangs up and looks at his list of possible witnesses. He puts a W next to Goldwater, Ford, and Carter, and that lets his fingers move down the list. Later in the courtroom, Judge Hackman is addressing Mooney, now with Hank Vito at his side. In another preliminary heating, the judge berates Mooney for running up a $1,200 phone bill, telling him his phone privilege will be taken away if he calls long distance one more time. Mooney responds with a, "So does that mean there is no equal treatment under the law?" Robert doesn't like this situation, so he switches off to another dimension to do another research, leaving Bobby in his chair. Bobby, in turn, loses himself in a daydream, staring into a box of legal documents on the floor to his left. Later, Frieda intros a new interview with Bob and company. Clark runs the camera, Frieda explains Moody's possible mental disorder, and sets the scene for a visit from a specialist in dissociative identity disorder who is coming to test the accused. A few days later, Dr. Gail Vane, a 50-ish California psychologist, sits across from Bob in the jail conference room. She shuffles through papers Bob has given her. Bob, Frieda, and Dr. Vane are hooked up. Clark is focusing on Bob through his viewfinder as Dr. Vane asks him questions about his diagnosis. Madison Street and about the psychologist's suggestion that DID be ruled out. Vane gives him one paragraph contract for him to sign, promising not to hurt himself on others. At the bottom of the contract there are lines for several personalities to sign. He speaks of having 13 personalities, but only 4 manifest, including XE. He wipes his hands on his pants. Bob's face flushes, and he fights against the manifestation of another personality. The room fills with heat. Everyone begins to sweat. Clark is asked to open the door. XE is present for a moment. Then he fades, and Bob retakes command. Outside the jail, Dr. Vane, Frieda, and Clark walk toward our cars. Dr. Vane stops at the curb at the edge of the parking lot near their Mercedes convertible. Frieda and Clark stop with her. She tells her that the decision they've made is to get this done. Do you want Bobby to be punished for the murders? That's what will happen if we leave everything alone. Bobby will go to lethal injection and take the poison for all the others. Later, in the conference room, Clark films Bob and Frieda engaged in another conversation. Bob has a yellow pad and pencil. He draws a circle and divides it into 15 unequal pie sections. He gives each section a name. 2 sections have the letter 13 written in them. We begin to learn about the complexity of Moody's DID. Later, in the regular family visitation room, Moody's ex-wife Terry and his daughter Annie, 11, speak with Bob over the telephone while they face him, separated by a glass wall. His ex-wife tells him she will testify he's been a good provider and husband. His daughter tells him she loves him, believes in him, and she'll testify what a good dad he's been to her. The first day of the trial, we see the jury file in. The quality of this jury is poor. It's made up entirely of South Tucson people who've been drinking TEC-laden water since the 1950s, and people who are so dumb they couldn't find their way out of a jury duty. There's not a healthy, vital person among them, not one who doesn't believe in capital punishment. Moody is wearing an all-fitting thrift shop suit provided at the public defender's office. Next to him sits Hank Vito, the prosecutor. Daryl Black concludes his opening statement, which gives the theme of his argument, The use of crack cocaine turns this insurance executive into a killer. Judge Hackman looks over his glasses at the jury, then at Black. He looks over at Moody, who is bent over his box of documents, digging for something. Behind him, digging for something, we see the defense side of the audience. Most of the seats are empty while the seats are filled behind Black tables. Several times, laughter comes from the prosecution side of the audience, the right side, behind the prosecutor table. The seats, which are packed with the families of the victims and others who want to see Robert Moody executed by the state. Robert gathers up his notes, whispers a moment with Vito, then stands prepared to act on his own defense attorney. He walks confidently into the railing and begins his opening statement, telling the jurors he was possessed by aliens, which made him kill the two victims so that they can bring the truth of the existence of aliens to the public attention. Gary Stallone shouts, "What a joke," in the middle of the presentation. The judge interrupts Moody and tells him to take another time, since there is no alien defense in Pima County. Moody then tells the jury that he's been in communication with Sherry Stallone on the other side, and she's happier over there than she was married to Gary. The victims' families gasp. Gary Stallone leaps to his feet and shouts, "We're going to watch you die." The judge ignores the outburst. After lunch break, Prosecutor Black continues presenting the prosecution case. "The drugs made him do it," prosecution says. Unconvincing evidence is presented. The chain of custody of evidence is non-existent. The technical witnesses on blood and DNA give inconclusive statements. The prosecution is winning by boring the jury into a stupor. Jurors begin to nod. One begins to snore. ATM photos of Moody supposedly getting money from his victims' accounts show nothing but white light reflected off the top of somebody's head. Black goes over to the murderers using floor plans of the house. Most of the evidence is hearsay. Nobody objects. Black goes over the crime step by step with a printer. The place where the body was found is marked and is outlined. He begins to place photos of evidence, the knife, a rifle, phone cords, chairs, on the diagram in their proper location. The victims' families react emotionally. Gary Stallone shouts ugly comments at Bob. The prosecution side of the courtroom gets ugly. The victims' families display their anger. Forensic specialists pray to the stand and testify about the evidence found at both crime scenes. Robert refuses to cross-examine any of them. A similar floor plan of Peg Stegman's house is presented. Similar photos are placed upon the diagram at the appropriate places by a detective. More yawns from the jury. The forensics are sloppy. No mention of the testimony of Lopez that got grand jury indicted. In the hall outside the courtroom, Dr. Vane is sitting across the floor at the courtroom. Frida exits and talks with Vane, who tells her that she's appalled by the ignorance of this court. She asks, "Why doesn't someone tell them that Moody's criminally insane?" On a video clip from the UFO encounters, Frida recaps the trial and explains the role of DID and plays it. She reveals the percentage of misdiagnosed and undiagnosed cases found on death row around the nation. She points out that there is a lack of facilities in the U.S. for mental health treatment and that mentally ill people are filing our jails and prisons and being killed as fast as they can be by the courts. The next day, the jury goes into deliberation. In the jury room, a large trailer trash female juror carries out an orange cake box. Another carries 2 12-packs of Sprite. The large woman produces the cake with 81 candles. The cake is a hideous Halloween ghoul's face with sharp pointed and missing teeth. Across its forehead are the homeless icing words, "Happy 80th, Elmer." The Sprite is passed around along with a large slice of cake. The large woman lights the candles, then pushes the cake at Elmer. Elmer gets confused. He bows his head to pray, then lifts it. Elmer tries, but doesn't have the wind. Large woman helps him blow. As the spirit of celebration swells in the hearts of the jurors, the foreman calls for a vote on the trial. All 12 hands go up, most covered with icing and cake. The large woman leads the song.